Hello, hello. Welcome back to A Rip in the Veil, your safe place to discuss everything that makes you feel unsafe. Now, before we get started, I know I always do a little update intro. I am working on my sound quality. Unfortunately, I have troubleshot the fuck out of it, and I have found that it is the mic itself. So I'm trying a couple new things, so hopefully your ears are happier with this. And then I'm also working on a website. I want to put transcripts up. I'll probably start with posting my notes because I do type my notes out, and then move to posting full transcripts in time. And like I've said in the past, with the Bridgewater Triangle episode, I'm a very visual person, and I would really like to be able to have a place to post things. Like, I had an interactive map that I've had a hard time sharing the link for. And for this episode, and in particular, I wanted to make an interactive timeline. But the only issue with that is that it is, again, hard to find a place to post it. So I'm working on a website to do that as well. As someone who's hard of hearing, I just want to be sure that I'm kind of all-inclusive so anyone can listen or read along to my fucking rambling. So how kind of me, right? If you guys like the idea of having a website where you can read and follow along with some kind of, you know, visual guide, shoot me an email at aritvpodcast@gmail.com. So welcome to Rip in the Veil's first official true crime episode. And I think most of us can agree that true crime is like 1,000 times scarier than most paranormal and supernatural encounters. I'm sure those who have been like possessed and shit would probably argue that. But even after the experience I've had that I mentioned in my first episode, even though I can't explain those things, the one thing I truly fear on a more daily basis is the actions of other humans. So as I've said in the past, also, I do have a medical background and I would consider myself a woman of science, which makes the supernatural even more interesting because there's so little evidence or no true explanation. That being said, true crime is chillingly interesting in the worst possible way because unfortunately we do have a lot of facts to prove that what happened actually happened, which might be worse. But I have actually strongly considered getting into the forensic field myself. It's one of my first and longest standing interests, really. I was that weird kid with the fingerprinting powder, taking everyone's prints off of everything in the house and making up scenarios like a game of Clue, which was an awesome game, by the way. And I did intend on doing more true crime than I already have, but I just had some other topics that I wanted to cover first, but I'll probably start rotating it in more regularly, so if you're a real true crime buff, then stay tuned. Now, in episode 3 in the Shanghai Tunnels and episode 4 with the Bridgewater Triangle, they did have some true crime mixed in because the two are really closely related. I mean, of course, there are, you know, the run-of-the-mill hauntings, you know, the lady in white or whatever, you know, where people see apparitions. But usually, I feel like there's always some tragedy fueling the paranormal fire, you know what I mean? What did I say in the Shanghai episode? Where there's pain, there's paranormal. Cheesy, but I mean, honestly true. So one of my favorite crime shows is Criminal Minds, and I'm sure a lot of you guys are familiar. They really get into the behavior and the psychological reasoning these people have that drives them to these crimes. I mean, fuck, it is called Criminal Minds for a reason, and it's disturbingly interesting. So it only seems fitting that our first true crime-only episode is one that a Criminal Minds episode is based off of. So this is from season 4, episode 25, and the episode is called To Hell... am Back. Is loosely based off of the real serial killer. No, it's quite the opposite. The real serial killer, Robert Picton. I do believe he actually might have been one of the first serial killers I ever heard of, like as a kid, because I distinctly remember the whole pig thing. What pig thing, you ask? Oh, you just wait. Now, it wouldn't be a Rip in the Veil episode if there wasn't some type of disclaimer. We are going to talk about his childhood and personal history, and while I truly do not mean to sympathize, because seriously, fuck him, I do think it is important to understand how these criminal minds, work, which is why I love that show so much. So this is actually just a Criminal Minds ad. We're done here. Goodbye. Good night. And we're back. And as you can imagine, this shit is gonna be graphic, including people being fed to pigs. So, deep breath. Are you ready? Didn't think so. Let's fucking do this. This piece of shit, aka Robert Willie Picton, aka the pig farm killer, was born on October 24th, 1949, in Port Coquitlam, British Columbia, in Canada. But as Stevie Cameron, who writes for the Toronto Star, found out, these murderous motherfuckers are usually at least partly formed by their environment. Cue the parents. So, it is said by family friends that the father, Leonard, didn't have nearly as much influence on the children as the mother, Louise, who ran the family biz and expected the kids to commit to it as well. So the family business was a pig farm. Picton developed a close relationship with the pigs as he grew up. He said himself that he never really fully recovered after a calf he raised was slaughtered, and it's been reported that he would even crawl inside of pig carcasses to hide from somebody. Now, some have even said that Leonard violently abused Robert, while his sister Linda seemed to have a much more affectionate relationship with the father, which is also strange. So who gave a heavier influence on Robert is hard to say, like which parent, but I mean, he wasn't hiding in pig carcasses for nothing, so who knows. As you can imagine, he had a hard time fitting in. He struggled with school, and as you can imagine, he smelled like shit, like literally. Seriously, not shaming anybody that has struggled with their natural body odor, because we're talking like eau de parfum of carcasses and manure. He apparently feared showers and would only rarely take baths. So he does have like I mentioned, his sister Linda, he does have other siblings, one of them being his little brother Dave. And just to kind of give some more insight on who raised this demon, at one point, Dave hit a kid with a truck. He was 16 and just got his license. And the poor kid's name was Tim Barrett, and he was only 14. So he was badly injured by the truck. And when Dave confessed this to his mom, like told her what he did, she went to the road that he was hit and found the boy, and instead, like, saw he was really injured, and instead of trying to help him, she pushed him off the side of the road, which dropped off into a swamp. What makes this even more heartbreaking and terrible is that an autopsy revealed that the truck wasn't even what killed him. He drowned. So he was still alive, and it said he would have recovered from those injuries, even though they were severe, but no, he drowned. So Louise, the mom, was never convicted, and Dave was sent to juvie. So fuck this family. Unfortunately, this is only the beginning, and it kind of just set the stage for more horrible things to happen. Let me set this disgusting scene for you, okay? So we're still in Port Coquitlam, British Columbia, Canada. It's 1996, and Robert and David Picton started to stray away from their oh-so-normal, oh-so-typical farm activities and registered the farm as a non-profit organization. And they started to throw giant parties on the property that hosted upwards of like 2,000 people. Those that frequented the parties were workers, sex workers from Vancouver. So as you can imagine, Picton was obviously known for being strange, but his first run-in with the law didn't actually happen until March 23rd, 1997, when he was convicted of attempted murder of Wendy Lynn Eistetter, a sex worker who visited the farm presumably for a party. So Picton handcuffed her, and she suffered from some stab wounds, but she was able to get away. She stabbed him with his own weapon, fucking right, go ahead, girl, and she was able to run and get help, and someone picked her up off of a highway and took her to a hospital. Here's the fucked up part. Robert was dismissed on just a $2,000 bond for attempted murder, and the charge was dismissed in 98 because the victim was deemed unreliable due to previous drug use. Even though the key to the handcuffs she was wearing was found in Picton's pocket, and that's how they took them off of her at the hospital. Are you fucking kidding me? That wasn't enough? You really think she's gonna let someone stab her? Really? Really? It wasn't until 2002, when the farm was investigated for illegal firearms, that the police found something belonging to one of the missing women, and then everything just started to fall into place. So, there was actually a publication ban on all the deets of what Picton actually did to his victims, and it wasn't until 2010, when the ban was lifted, that we really knew what these women endured. Now, it is worthy to note that there were more than 80 DNA samples, and it was about a 50-50 male-to-female mix, that could not be identified that were found on the farm. Of course, there were a lot of people that went through there, but come on, seriously, fuck. Like, you would think that if they're doing a murder investigation, you know, and people that had gone to those parties, if they could get in contact with them, they provide a DNA sample, yada yada. It does make you wonder, you know, especially because 50% of them are male, where are those, did anyone else partake? That was my question when I saw that. I was like, okay, those 50% that are males, I was like, are they other victims? Were they workers on the farm, friends? Did they partake themselves? Is this like a, you know, was this a larger operation? I mean, really, who knows? Upon further investigation, all right, so this is where we start getting into the graphic shit, you guys. If you have children around, you shouldn't. I cuss a lot. You shouldn't have children, but if they're still around, they need to leave. Okay, here's your cue. Upon further investigation, police found various bits of human remains in trash bags around the farm that were literally difficult to piece together and give an identity to because they had been fed to pigs on the farm. There were also human skulls that had been split, and hands and feet were stuffed inside of them. Okay, now, pause. That's some Edward Gein type shit, right? Edward Gein, if you don't know, oh, we'll do an episode on him, but look him up. Go look up Edward Gein. If you want to see what he's all about, throw the words nipple belt in there, and it'll get you where you want to go. So that's some fucked up shit. Seriously enough to give you the willies. Poor taste. Too soon. It'll always be too soon. Now, victims' bloody clothing was also found on the property, teeth and jawbones, and the potentially poisonous or dangerous Spanish fly aphrodisiac that is known to cause all kinds of things, nasty side effects. It increases blood flow, but it can also blister your skin, so that's awesome. And syringes with a blue liquid. We'll touch more on that later. Handcuffs and night vision goggles were also found. I don't know why, but the night vision goggles creep me out too. Like, I know it's not just the worst thing. I just imagine Robert Picton with night vision goggles on creeping around. I don't know. It's just enough. Enough to give you the willies. There were also various guns found on the property, including a revolver with a homemade silencer made out of a dildo. No words. Some have even said humans were ground up and mixed with the pig meat and possibly sold to the public. Luckily for us, this despicable fuck is behind bars for life, rightfully so. Though I wish he would be fed to pigs alive, but I guess him being locked up will just have to suffice. If you have a loved one locked up with Robert Picton, can you take care of him for us? Thank you. I think it's also important to note that Robert was fucking suspicious for a while, okay? Some were either afraid to come forward or the tips just were not taken seriously. And law enforcement definitely got some heat for this. One of the mistakes being that after he attempted the murder in 97, and the charges were dropped, they had personal items of Picton's that were just held and they were not tested for DNA until years later, and two missing persons' DNA were found on the boots that were held for all of those years. You know, you would think that attempted murder is a huge red flag, right? Like, I know this was 20 years ago, but seriously, like, we know if someone's willing to attempt murder and it's not like a crime of passion, usually that's not their first offense. Can we all agree on that? Okay. So Bill Hiscox, S-I-S-C-O-X, was a worker on the farm and became suspicious of Picton after 3 years he noticed that women who visited would eventually go missing. So Hibiscus, you know who I'm talking about. He was not the first to know something was up, which makes it even worse. So this is a direct quote from Wikipedia that was actually a part of what was used as evidence against Picton. So a videotape of Picton's friend Scott Chubb was used as evidence, saying Picton told him a good way to kill a female heroin addict was to inject her with windshield washer fluid. A second tape was played for Picton, in which an associate named Andrew Bellwood said Picton mentioned killing sex workers by handcuffing and strangling them, then bleeding and gutting them before feeding them to the pig. Couple things. I think we can all agree and make an educated guess that the syringes filled with blue stuff that we talked about earlier were windshield wiper fluid, right? Great. And seriously, fuck those two guys. You had... Again, maybe they wouldn't have been taken seriously, but you just had someone admit to murder to you, which again makes me think, were they a part of it? I hope they got those two guys' DNA and compared it to the 40 or so unknown male samples. If you knew about that, there's only a few reasons you wouldn't come forward, right? Moving on. Lynn Ellingson also came forward after the arrest, saying that she saw a woman hanging from meat hooks being skinned by Picton. Apparently, she used this information to blackmail him a few times, but was too scared to come forward. So why she needed to use it as blackmail, I don't know, but obviously Lynn is just as fucking sketchy, so she can't be trusted. Police also got a tip to investigate Robert in 98 in reference to all the missing women in the area, and they apparently did not have enough resources to investigate. They also received a tip in 99, just the following year, that Picton had a, quote, freezer of human flesh, quote, on his farm. They never searched the area, even after they interviewed him and he gave them permission to search the property. Which I know, psychologically speaking, you know, like they say that means you don't have a lot to hide. But are you really taking that chance? He's been sus for a while. Whatever. Honestly, obviously it's a little bit too late, but hopefully the police in the area have learned their lesson. Because if these shortcomings have told us anything, it's to trust your gut. You get the heebie-jeebies from your neighbor, trust it. You think you might have seen something sus? Trust it. You saw a woman hanging from meat hooks? You fucking go to the police! So think of how many victims would still be alive if the tips were taken more seriously and those who had seen or heard something actually came forward. Unfortunately, that is probably a question the families of these victims ask themselves every day. And unfortunately, there were a lot of victims. Some he didn't get charged for either lack of evidence or the fact that he had reached the maximum sentence when he finally was charged. I did my best to find information on individual encounters, but with this number of victims, a lot of resources kind of just list them off. Picton admitted to an undercover since he's been locked up, that he had 49 victims and was essentially too eager to hit the big 5-0, fucking barf, and he got sloppy, and that's why he got caught, because he was just, like, too eager to get that 50th victim. So that being said, I'm going to include all known possible victims of which he was convicted or not, because they deserve to be talked about. He could only be linked to murders starting in 1991, but still. You know, I'm not saying that we're going to go through the victims in sections. Yes, there are sections. Yes, there are that many victims. But I feel even if they weren't Pictons, you know, I'm sure no one's really talking about them anymore, and they at least deserve that. So considering a lot of sex workers were Picton's victims, all too often, these were overlooked and dismissed, these cases were. Which is a part of an ongoing issue of not only these killers, but society not viewing those sex workers as real people. This is very much reflected in Picton's cases and the lack of information and justice for these women. Now, most of his victims frequented an area that was called the Low Track, which is the downtown east side in Vancouver. And that's an area that's filled with a lot of impoverished people, and it's no stranger to drugs and prostitution. Now, missingpeople.net is definitely one of the most detailed timelines you're going to find, and that's where I got a lot of the missing people that were not, you know, could not be linked to Picton, but I still think are worth mentioning. And they do point out on missingpeople.net that sex workers are inherently elusive and they can be hard to track due to name changes and some wanted to disappear. So it is hard to say. Now, it also seems to be a common theme that they are usually not reported missing quickly. Is this due to others not wanting to get involved? Or maybe they, you know, don't have people expecting them at the end of the day, so it gets kind of shrugged off until it's obviously a problem? I don't know, it's probably a combination of things, but either way, it's fucking terrible. So this is a long list. I apologize if this gets boring, but we need to say their names. I understand if you skip ahead, but I really do want to show them some level of respect. We're starting with those that Picton was not charged, accused, or implicated with, for, you know what I mean. I did cross-reference this with those lists, like his actual charges, so there should not be any repeats. This is quoted directly from missingpeople.net because these are mostly names and dates, and it would be really hard to paraphrase without plagiarizing, and that would just be a dick move, so here we go. These are missing women from the downtown east side area during that time period. Rebecca Guno, 23, last seen June 22nd, 1983. 43-year-old Sherry Rail, not reported missing until 3 years after her 1984 disappearance. 33-year-old Elaine Auerbach, A-U-E-R-B-A-C-H. She told friends she was moving to Seattle in March 86, but never arrived. Teresa Ann Williams, 26-year-old, last seen July 1988, wasn't reported missing until the following year. 14 months elapsed between the August 89 disappearance of a 40-year-old mental patient, Ingrid Sowett. She was not reported missing until the following year. The first African-American victim, Catherine Watley, was 39 years old when she vanished in 92. The unknown predator slash predators, because at this time they weren't sure, took a 3-year vacation before claiming a 47-year-old Catherine Gonzalez in 95, wasn't reported till 96. In April of the same year, 32-year-old Catherine Knight went missing for 7 months before she was reported. Dorothy Spence, a 36-year-old, she went missing in 95 as well. And Olivia Williams, she rated less concern at age 22. And her disappearance that from 96 was not reported until 97. Stephanie Lane, the youngest victim so far at age 20, she went missing in 97. Jeanette Henry, she actually survived a near miss with a different serial killer, Clifford Olson, in the 1980s. And then she disappeared again in 97. Jacqueline Murdoch, she was 28, was not reported missing until 98. 33-year-old Sydney Beck, she dropped out of sight in 97 and wasn't reported till 98. Sheila Egan, a prostitute since age 15, vanished at age 20 in 98 and was reported fairly soon after considering. Julie Young, age 33, she was last seen in October that same year. Not reported until 99. The next year, Michelle Gurney, age 30, was missing in December that year. And was reported missing 3 days before Christmas. 20-year-old Marcella Creason, she got out of jail December 27, 1998, but never returned to her apartment where her mother and boyfriend were preparing a belated Christmas dinner. So that's also super sad. After they started the investigation, so from the 80s, they listed presumed kidnapped victims Leigh Minor, last seen in 84, and Laura Mah, M-A-H, whose date of disappearance was simply listed as 1985. There were details lacking for vanished Elsie Sebastian in 92, 17-year-old Angela Arsenault, in 94 and Francis Young in 96. And then one more, 52-year-old Maria Lalibert. Her last known appearance was on the low track on New Year's Day. I think those got a little bit scrambled. I want to say that was one of the 80s ones. Okay, so others were investigated for those missing persons, other offenders in the area, and they were eventually ruled out. So let's get into the victims that Picton was eventually nailed for. At least there's something. So on December 9th in 2007, Picton was convicted of second-degree murder in the deaths of Serena Abatswe. She was reported missing in 2001. Mona Lee Wilson, age 26, she was reported missing 2001 as well. Andrea Josbury, age 22, last seen June 2001. Brenda Ann Wolfe, age 32, was last seen February 1999. Marnie Lee Frey, last seen August 97. Georgina Faith Pappin, last seen January 99. So those were the ones he was convicted of. Now, he also stood accused of first-degree murder for 21 other women, but these charges were stayed on August 4th, which is what I was talking about earlier, where he had already met the maximum sentence, so they no longer, like, gave him more time because he got the maximum, but, you know, I feel like everybody has different opinions on how that was handled. So, Jacqueline Michelle McDonald, age 23, went missing in 99. Diane Rosemary Rock, 34, missing in 01. Heather Kathleen Bottomley, 27, she was reported missing in 01. Jennifer Lynn Firminger, last seen 99. Helen May Hallmark, last seen August 97. Patricia Rose Johnson, last seen in March 01. Heather Chinook, 30, she was last seen April 2001. Tanya Holick, 23, last seen 96. Sherry Irving, 24, was last seen 97. Inga Monique Hall, 46, last seen February 98. Tiffany Drew, last seen December 99. Sarah DeVries, last seen April 98. Cynthia Felix, last seen December 97. Angela Rebecca Jardine, last seen November 20th, 1998. Diane Melnick, last seen December 95. There's a Jane Doe in here. Of course, could not be identified, and this charge was lifted, so that's why it's common to see that he was charged with 6 murders, but stayed on 20 charges. It's technically 21, but that's why the 26 are commonly referenced. Deborah Lynn Jones, last seen December 2000. Wendy Crawford, last seen December 99. Carrie Koski, last seen January 98. Andrea Faye Borhaven, March 97. And Kara Louise Ellis, aka Nikki Trimble, she was last seen in 96. So those are the 21 counts that he was stayed for. He was also implicated in the murders of the following women, but charges have not yet been laid. This is apparently an incomplete list. I don't know if that will ever change. Again, if they already stayed all these other charges, I really don't know if that's going to change anything. But again, we're going to say their names. Mary Ann Clark, aka Nancy Greek. She was 25 and she disappeared in 91. Yvonne Marie Bowen. Sometimes under the surname England. She was 33 and last seen in 01. Dawn Teresa Cray, or Cree, C-R-E-Y, reported missing in 2000. So she was also the main subject of a 2006 documentary film about murdered and missing women in Canada entitled Finding Dawn. If you want to check that out. And then there are 2 more unidentified women that he was implicated for, so that makes 3 Jane Does. So 3 women, 3 families that will never know, they will never know. So if that doesn't make it any more horrible. So 32 women, including the Jane Does, that he was either convicted, accused, or implicated for. Holy shit. So the previous list was 24, and that brings us to 56, which I know is obviously over the 49 number that Picton claimed, but it's still worth mentioning. So honestly, let's fucking take a moment of silence for these poor souls. Well, that was fucked up, wasn't it? If you want to hear more of this motherfucker's story, there are movies and documentaries about these events, and of course that Criminal Minds episode, again it's season 4, episode 25, that is based off of Picton, obviously loosely, it's not a documentary of his life, but the pigs are involved, so if that piqued your interest, there you go. But, you know, I think that's enough for today, you guys. So until next time, friends.